Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual podcast on iHeart and Radio MD. And of course, thanks for downloading us. Please do rate us. Please do tell your friends about us. And we have a great guest for you in this special session. It's 867C. Dr. Richard Webby is a world-renowned expert on the flu virus, a member of the WHO, that's the World Health Organization team, responsible for deciding what flu strains to put in the vaccine for the next year. He is a member of the Infectious Disease Department at St. Jude's Children's Research Center. That's how you can find out about him, www.stjudes.org. Actually, it's just St. Jude, no apostrophe S, stjude.org, and is known as a, if you will, the flu chaser, I guess you'd call him. What is, tell me how you got interested in the flu, Dr. Webby, and thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. So I guess I got interested in the flu having done my training in New Zealand, and I was just looking for to sort of expand my horizons, and I think influenza has always been a something that I've been interested in as something to, I guess, study. One, you know, because of the impact it has on us every year, and also because of the, you know, the catastrophic consequences that sometimes throws at us, you know, two or three times a century when we get a pandemic coming over. So, you know, there's lots to learn about this virus.
So we'll get into the difference between a pandemic and what we normally have. But tell us, you were in New Zealand. Doesn't New Zealand get the flu half a year before we do in America? That is, doesn't the Southern Hemisphere get it earlier? Is that right, or am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. So at least in the more temperate climate, flu is a winter disease. And as you've just alluded to, of course, the winters down there are during the July, August month. So, you know, that's when the peak flu seasons in the Southern Hemisphere countries occur. And so that does occur some 6 months before we start to see things up here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Now, and is that how the vaccine is chosen? You're known as, quote, the flu catcher by nature. And that doesn't mean you catch it, but you are one of those responsible for figuring out what strains to put in the flu vaccine. I assume we get here. Do they get the vaccine 6 months earlier in New Zealand and Australia and the Southern Hemisphere countries?
Yeah, they do. And you know, so I guess to be accurate, there are a lot of flu chasers out there, flu catchers who are involved in this process. So there is the World Health Organization, which certainly we here at St. Jude are part of in this effort, has a collection of over about 140-odd labs around the world that collect flu viruses during their flu season. So, again, for the Southern Hemisphere, that, you know, sort of April, well, more June, July, August, Northern Hemisphere countries, it's, of course, during our winter. And they collect these viruses during their flu seasons, and they send them off to, there are six collaborating centers within this group, which look at that information. So twice a year we get together, once in February to think about what needs to be in the vaccine for the coming Northern Hemisphere season, and again in September to think about what needs to be in the vaccine for the Southern Hemisphere. So yeah, they're coming back to your question. We do look very, very closely at what's gone on in the previous season in the other hemisphere, you know, hoping that that'll give us some indication of perhaps what to expect going forward. And there are two different vaccines made, or sometimes are different, sometimes are the same, one for the Northern Hemisphere, one for the Southern.
That was the next question that you anticipated. And is there better, I would guess, uptake or better compliance with desire to have flu vaccine in the Southern Hemisphere countries, or is it the same? Is it, in other words, we're around 50% now, is that right?
Yeah, somewhere around that, I think, as a whole. I think looking at the global market, the US is a pretty major consumer of the flu vaccine. You look at at least the recommendations for who should get it in the US, and it's certainly getting broader and broader as who's recommended. And some other countries around the world, that's much, of course, some countries don't have it at all, but those that do, they tend to target more of the high risk populations and younger children as well.
So in New Zealand or Australia, would as high a percentage or would it be a lower percentage? And why does the flu vaccine come in the winter months?
Yeah, so the first question, I think it's my guess, and I don't have the figures in front of me, but my guess is the coverage in probably all other countries in the world is lower than in the US. And particularly that includes Australia and in New Zealand. Your next question is, it's one of the big unknowns about flu that we really should know, right? That it's a winter disease. So, you know, we all know when this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere, flu activity starts to pick up. We get this peak in the winter months and then it goes away. The bottom line is we don't really know why that is. There's probably a lot of different factors that play into it. Some of the theories are that, you know, during winter, we tend to huddle around a bit more, stay indoors. So perhaps there's more chance for the virus to get around. We also know from studies that have gone on that the flu virus, like various sort of environmental conditions, so certain temperatures, certain humidities, it seems to stay around in the air a little bit longer, which allows it to transmit a little bit better. And so it's probably a combination of all these factors that means it comes in a winter disease. I think, the other thing to keep in mind is, we talk about the northern and southern hemispheres, but there's also a bunch of countries that are essentially around the equator. And quite often, flu season for them is a little bit more of a year-round disease. And quite often, they may have a couple of peaks of influenza activity.
Now, while we're on it, is this flu season, you're in North America, you're located where specifically?
In Memphis, Tennessee.
So that's where St. Jude Hospital is, and that's why it's stjude.org, and you're a member of the infectious disease department there. And I want to get into the antiviral therapies in a few minutes, but before we get into that, what's predicted for this flu season? It looks on the, when you look at the reporting or the advanced reporting, it looks like it's about an average flu season, but I've heard reports CDC is scared it's going to be a very serious one. Why are they scared of that? Or is that just to try and get people immunized more, or what's going on?
Well, I'm sure they, of course, want to get more people immunized, but it's a really difficult thing for us to actually try and predict is the severity of a flu season. One thing we can look is perhaps what has gone on in the seasons just past in the Southern Hemisphere. And this year it was really a bit of a mixed bag. So the Australians had one of their most severe seasons in a number of years. It was caused by a virus we call the H3N2 virus. And they had a lot of vaccine problems with the vaccine, perhaps not being as effective as we would like, and a lot of disease. Whereas other countries had a little bit more of a mild season. So, even looking at what's gone on down below us doesn't really help us a whole lot in trying to predict what's coming. I think in the US, at least there was earlier on, there seemed to be some quite early cases of the same H3N2 virus appearing. So, that perhaps might have fed into some of the predictions that we're in for a bumper season. And at the moment, as you've just said, activity is somewhat normal, perhaps a little bit more than we might expect for this time of year. To be honest, I think going forward, what we're going to expect, your guess is as good as mine.
More with Dr. Michael Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast coming up. Here's the deal. To truly thrive in all areas of your life, you cannot ignore the importance of good health. I've learned this firsthand, and for many of us, time is our most valuable asset. This is why I love Organifi Green Juice, an organic superfood green juice powder you just add water to get your greens anytime, anywhere, without the mess. Plus, you can now enjoy Organifi Red Juice Powder too. When you invest in your health, you gain more time because you have more energy and focus to get through your day. The best thing about Organifi Green and Red Juice is that it actually tastes good. Try it for yourself. Use the code YOU, Y-O-U, at Organifi.com. That's O-R-G-A-N-I-F-I.com. Once again, use the code YOU, that's Y-O-U, to receive 20% off your order at Organifi.com. And You, the Owner's Manual podcast, is brought to you by Memory Rescue, the brand new book that can help you with your memory. Let's hear from its author.
Hi, I'm Dr. Daniel Amen, author of a new book called Memory Rescue. Memory Rescue teaches you how to prevent future problems, but if you're having memory problems now, how to rescue it, how to get it back so that everything in your life can be better. Plant the habits that I talk in your life. I know it'll make a dramatic difference for you and for those you love.
It's important that you receive this information. Get your copy of Memory Rescue by Dr. Daniel Amen. Learn more at memoryrescuebook.com. That's memoryrescuebook.com. And now back to Dr. Michael Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast.
Now, before we get into the antiviral, that is, medicines that are like antibacterials but treat viral disease, obviously not exactly like, but I should tell people it's not too late to get the vaccine, that it does take 2 to 3 weeks to get to its full effectiveness, and that getting it 10 years in a row is a major benefit in adults, at least in preventing death from all causes, not just the flu, but the flu causes an inflammatory state, so it is associated with a very high rate of heart attack and stroke from breaking off plaque, we think. And so people over the age of 50 should really consider getting it every year. We do, obviously, in a hospital. I'm at the Cleveland Clinic, and everyone gets it here unless there is a strong contraindication to what is involved in making or in the properties or components of the flu vaccine. So if you don't get the flu vaccine but get the flu, what are the steps you should take, or what can you take to avoid serious consequences, Dr. Webby?
So, yeah, if you didn't head off to the pharmacy to get your vaccine and you get symptoms of what you think is flu, yeah, the most important thing is to head to the doc as early as you can. So there are some drugs that we can use to treat influenza. The most commonly available in the US is what we call Tamiflu. And so this is a drug that actually binds to the virus and inhibits its replication. Some of the problems with, well, not the problems, but the downsides of this treatment is it is most effective when taken as close to when you get infected as possible. So that's why it's important to head to the doc and get tested for influenza. You know, as soon as you start to feel those symptoms of what's typically associated with influenza, so that the muscle aches and rapid onset, when you start to feel that, it's time to head and try and get some advice.
So men probably avoid going to the physician if at all possible. So guys, this is something that if you do something, you should do it early, because the flu is a sudden onset, does give you muscle aches, as well as just feeling absolutely rotten. And that's because you have a very high inflammatory state. And Tamiflu, as he said, is the drug that does bind to the flu, or does bind to the virus and prevents it from replicating. And you're working on another substance or another drug that does somewhat similar, but is more effective. Tell us about that, Dr. Webby.
Yes. So some of the problems we have with our current treatment, we've just discussed, you do have to take them early. So the virus can actually develop resistance to some of even Tamiflu. So there's a lot of effort going on in the research communities and sort of the biotech industries as well to try and come up with new antivirals. So we do have one project that we have ongoing here at St. Jude with a number of other people from different departments here, trying to look at targeting a different component of the virus. So the Tamiflu binds to a protein that we call neuraminidase, which sits on the outside of the virus. The compounds that we're trying to develop actually target a completely different part of the virus. They target part of the machinery that actually makes more copies of the viral genome. And our hope is that by developing this new class of drugs, and again, we're not the only ones looking at this. There are a number of people doing it, but the idea is that if we can target a different part of the virus, perhaps we can extend that treatment, the window where you can go and get treatment successfully, and perhaps even more powerfully, we could combine a couple of these medicines. So combine the Tamiflu that binds to the surface of the virus with one of these other drugs that sort of mess around with the way the virus replicates, and by using them together, which we've seen in a lot of other diseases, of course, often you'll get much better activity and your chances of the virus becoming resistant are greatly reduced. So lots of sort of activity going on around the place in this area. A number of different targets are actually being explored.
Now, this, if it were developed, would not presumably relieve the need for the flu vaccine, but would help us in case of pandemics and maybe even other viruses that are, if you will, more dangerous from a standpoint of have a greater consequence to them. Is that possible, or am I just dreaming?
No, you're not dreaming at all. So your first point, development of antivirals certainly doesn't negate the need for vaccination. Vaccination is by far the best way to protect yourself from getting infected. And, of course, a vaccine can protect you from getting infected. Antivirals are typically given after you've been infected and you're starting to feel sick. So vaccine is by far the best approach. The problem with with flu vaccines at least, is that they have to be pretty well matched in terms of what's in the vaccine to what strain you're going to be infected, what strain of flu you're going to be infected with. We've all heard of the so-called mismatch flu seasons where the circulating strains have changed a little bit from what's in the vaccine, and sometimes that limits the effectiveness of the vaccine. But the other scenario that you just talked about was a pandemic. So this is when an influenza, so actually all influenza viruses, humans are not the natural host for influenza viruses. The natural host are actually some of the wild aquatic birds of the world. And, for reasons we don't fully understand, usually it's sort of 1, 2, 3 times a century, some of these viruses from the animal population spill over into humans. The 2009 swine flu was the last time we had one of these pandemics. What happened?
So we often call those bird flus or swine flus because they originate in the animals and propagate in them and then somehow hop species back to humans. Is that, am I getting that right?
You're getting that absolutely right. We'll quite often see a number of people infected with these animal flus over a year, but most of those are sort of just dead end events where one or two people will get infected, and not much will happen. But the pandemic occurs when these viruses jump from animals to humans, but then that virus starts going human to human to human. And sort of once all bets are off, once that starts to happen. And the problem with, you know, in terms of the medical profession trying to deal with that is to make a matching vaccine takes somewhere in the vicinity of about 6 months from production to putting it in the vials to delivering it to the pharmacy or your GP. So, you know, during that 6 month period, quite often the antivirals are the only thing available to treat the disease.
And now, is the flu and the virus replication so different that this wouldn't have use for other viral diseases? So, in other words, we've heard that the Zika virus and the, if you will, West Nile virus and other, there are a bunch of other viruses that we don't have very good treatments for. And what happened in developing Tamiflu is it, and others, it led to a new learnings about HIV, the retroviruses, and how to decrease their replication. Is the influenza type virus also likely to lead to other, if you will, benefits?
So there's actually a number of answers to that question. The first is absolutely. So almost any time we do research on one virus or organism or whatever, we learn something that is able to use in other systems. So I think that's just the nature of basic research. Although we're focused on one area, what we generate is useful in other areas. The other, I guess, more targeted answer to that is there are two ways that people are looking at developing antivirals, and this, whether this be flu, whether it be Zika, or whether it be HIV. One is the drugs like Tamiflu that specifically target the virus. So Tamiflu will bind to flu and inhibit flu, but not much else. But you know, the thing about viruses is essentially they're just a bunch of genes covered in protein. So if they're just sitting on a surface of something, they can't do much. They've got to get inside a cell of an animal, in this case humans, and start to replicate. So what people are starting to get a little bit clever about this and think, well, why don't we try and target some of the things inside the host cell that this virus requires? And in this case, perhaps you can target something in the host, and that will be protective against a range of different viruses. So one drug, but many, many, many different viral targets. And there are some drugs, you know, that are headed towards the market that have a lot of promise in that area.
So we're talking with Dr. Richard Webby. He's a research scientist at St. Jude's in Memphis. His website, or the website of St. Jude's, is www.stjude.org. And St. Jude obviously has a great tradition in dealing with childhood diseases, especially childhood cancers, it's known for. Where are we in developing a vaccine against some of the cancers? In other words, we know that HPV is a cancer, or HPV, human papillomavirus, leads to some of the cancers. Do we have any, especially throat and cervical cancers, do we have ideas on other cancers being triggered by viruses or virus-like particles? And where are we in vaccines for other potential cancers?
Yeah, so it's the whole area of cancer, in many respects, has grown up with the virology. And it's one of the questions I often get asked at St. Jude, being at a hospital that treats primarily pediatric cancers, why is there a program on influenza here? And that does go back to the fact that certainly some cancers are triggered by viral infection, and certainly a lot of what we're starting to learn, a lot initially of what we learned about what triggers cancer, what makes a cancer cell grow, you know, viruses were used as model system. Obviously, the papillomavirus is perhaps the best known system, virus causing cancer. And certainly we have some good vaccines against that. You know, where we are with some of the other cancers, you know, a lot of people are starting to look for some of those initial hits. And we know a lot of cancers are not just single hits. You have to have a number of perhaps one or two different insults with some genetic factors that contribute to cancer. So, you know, I think a lot of work trying to understand what triggers those. And certainly the vaccines that we develop for pathogens, whether they're virus or bacteria, you know, in many respects, it's the same fundamental theory that's going into developing cancer vaccines as well. And, you know, there are many of these approaches, and certainly people here at St. Jude are exploring those avenues as well. You know, exactly how far they are away from fruition, it's not my exact area of expertise. I couldn't put a figure on that one.
Now, one of the things since I tweeted you were coming on, and someone asked, how big is the entire research program, that is the basic research program at St. Jude's versus the clinical program? So St. Jude's is known for its treatment and its innovation in childhood cancers. How big is the research, the basic research program in the basic biology of cancers and other things?
Yeah, so it's probably a fair split down the middle. Saying that, even a lot of the clinical folks, so I'm a PhD doctor, so you know, don't come to me with a swollen thumb, but even the real docs here at St. Jude that treat the kids, the majority of them also have research programs. So it's actually a pretty fuzzy line between the clinical programs here at St. Jude and the research programs. But, you know, the institute was really built sort of when Danny Thomas, who was the founder of the hospital, you know, went out searching for advice on, you know, what to do with this hospital. He was advised very early on that he should put the scientists and the physician sort of in the same environment where they can certainly crosstalk. And that, you know, I think what really spurs on a lot of the innovation and treatment here at St. Jude, even today, is that having the basic researchers essentially side by side with the clinician. So again, for example, my department, the Department of Infectious Diseases, we have essentially split 50-50 with faculty members who, you know, treat the patients and have research programs versus, you know, those of us that are just having a research program. So again, exact figures I can certainly dig out, but, you know, it's probably a fair split down the middle.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Richard Webby. Thank you for both the insights on the flu and the overall program at St. Jude's. We should say that St. Jude's has, many people may not know who Danny Thomas was or is. He was a great entertainer, great comedian, and did start this incredible project that led to the founding of St. Jude's. StJude.org and is the way you can find more about Dr. Richard Webby and his research on developing, is really groundbreaking research in developing antiviral drugs and the new technique they are using. In the meantime, do get your flu shot and do download us and rate us weekly. This is You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast and Radio MD and iHeartRadio. Randall, thanks for great engineering. Dr. Webby, keep working, and thank you for doing all that you do to help with the flu. We'll be back next week with another great guest. One of the guests for next week is going to talk about hyperbaric oxygen and how it's being used, but more on that next week. So do download us. It's got some really interesting uses, even in the flu.